I want to begin my address this morning by taking us to a narrative found in Exodus where we are going to meet two extraordinary women of faith. Now, just as a quick reminder, the book of Exodus follows on straight from Genesis, and in the closing chapters in Genesis, we have that account of Joseph and his extended family living in Egypt, where Joseph had a very senior leadership role. And he'd been a key person in preventing widespread starvation to those living in Egypt and those in the surrounding nations. Joseph was famous throughout Egypt for his leadership. And in the opening words of Exodus, we read that the Egyptian Pharaoh, whose name, by the way, we aren't given, didn't know of the fame of Joseph, the Hebrew leader. So this unnamed Pharaoh is feeling that his power is being threatened by the large numbers of Hebrews now living in Egypt. They started there as a free people, the Hebrews. They came there fleeing hunger. So Pharaoh tries through, first of all, forced labour and then through slavery to reduce the numbers of these pesky Hebrews. But he finds that his plans aren't working out as he wanted them to. So now we're going to read from Exodus 1, 15 to 20. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of his own. What amazing women. Are there any midwives here? Sometimes in churches there are others. Okay. I think it's actually really difficult for us to understand the context that these women were living in, which I think makes it really hard for us to understand the brazenly scary act of civil disobedience that they did. Pharaohs were not like our prime ministers, who need to rely on the media and various arts of persuasion to achieve their goals. There's no prime minister in Australia who's ever been able to say, "Off with her head." Well, not that I know about. And have it happened. Imagine maybe a Pol Pot from the nation where I lived for a number of years, or a Mugabe, or a Kim Jong-un. Perhaps these are more contemporary examples that can give us a little understanding of what it was like for the women to do what they did. Being called into the presence of Pharaoh was not something that many wanted to happen. Most would be anxious to avoid it. And these were women, probably older women, and we know that they were women without a family. So these were low down in this patriarchal, hierarchical society of Egypt. And here they are, called into the presence of the God King. So these two women probably headed up the Midwives Guild in Egypt. And they were commanded to kill all the Hebrew boys during the birthing process, save the girls, but kill the boys. Those who are women who have given birth perhaps can appreciate how that could happen, particularly in the kind of setting when women were giving birth, not clinical hospitals, as we know. So Pharaoh's command for male infanticide was his next step in the plan that he had in his attempt to control this growing number of Hebrew men in his empire. And as we read, the midwives disobeyed this direct command. Now, given the size of Egypt, we do not imagine that these women, these two women, were at the births of all Hebrew boys. However, as guild leaders, it was their influence on the other midwives that resulted in the baby boys being born safely. And it is also quite probable that these women were not Hebrews. I know some translations lead us to think that it's Hebrew midwives, but the actual Hebrew says midwives to the Hebrews. So it's quite possible that these were tribal women, not Hebrew women, which I think makes it even more extraordinary. Now, these are clever women, and it must have occurred to them at some stage this act of civil disobedience was going to become obvious, surely. I mean, as they grow, as we know here, babies move, they make noise, and eventually the neighbours would see that these Hebrew households had little boys in them. Called back into Pharaoh's presence to please explain, how might you expect that they would reply? We read that they actually played up to Pharaoh's prejudices. In saying that the Hebrew women were vigorous, they actually tapped into the Pharaoh's own biases, because the actual word that they used of vigorous was a word that was then used to describe animals. So what the Pharaoh heard was, oh, these Hebrew women are like animals, and they have their babies so quickly, meaning the midwives can't get there to suffocate or strangle them. Weren't they clever? So they were very clever, and they used his own racial biases against him. And we are told that the Hebrew midwives did this because they feared the Lord. Their reverence and awe for the Lord shaped their actions. The writer of Exodus tells us that God then blessed them by giving them families of their own. And in a society where the value of a woman was based on her ability to bear and raise children, this really was a blessing. Now, I have a question for you, and it's not a rhetorical question, because I want you to think about it for a few seconds and then turn and share your response with your neighbour. All right? So here is the question. When you hear the phrase, the fear of the Lord, what are the thoughts and the feelings that it causes within you, this phrase, the fear of the Lord? So just take a couple of seconds, think about your response. So now turn and tell your neighbour, either in front of you, behind you, or next to you, what your response is to this phrase, the fear of the Lord. All right. I'm just wondering, would there be one or two people who would like just to stand up or call out loudly so that we can hear what the responses were that you shared or you heard? Is there somebody who'd like to be brave and do that? In awe of. In awe of? From the front? Some in awe.
Yeah,
so for this person? So any other responses to this phrase, the fear of the Lord? Okay, so used in the negative sense.
Is that what your parents do?
Sorry? Reverence. Okay. Better to fear God than to fear man. Thank you. I have an 87-year-old mother, and I was talking, or she came and heard me preach one Sunday, and she said to me as we were driving back from Manham that night, Karen, she said, I don't like that phrase, the fear of the Lord. And the story that unfolded was that she grew up in a household where the fear of God was a fearful thing. And the preaching that she was exposed to as a young girl and as a child was an ugly, fearful thing. So for her, this phrase has very strong negative connotations because of her heritage, I guess. So the phrase, the fear of the Lord, occurs in both parts of our Bible. I think many of us tend to think that the God of the Old Testament, the God of Moses, the God of floods, of plagues, of pestilence, burning bushes, judgment. So we're often not surprised when we come across this phrase, the fear of the Lord, in the Old Testament. But it might come as a surprise to some of us when we actually read this same phrase in the New Testament. And I think evangelicals tend to not really want to read the Old Testament, and we are a little uncomfortable with the God of the burning bush. So this idea that there's the fear of the Lord is actually in the New Testament too, which we hug so tightly, can be quite challenging. It is confusing for us to understand, I think, at times, what the phrase the fear of the Lord means. So we read in 1 John 4:18, the first six verses 16 to 17, and so we know and rely on the love God has for us. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. This is how love is made complete among us, so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. In this world, we are like Jesus. And then verse 18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. The type of fear that in 1 John we see being described is a fear of punishment, a fear of judgment. That's the kind of fear that my mother grew up understanding. When we look at those earlier verses there in 1 John, we read that believers in Christ have confidence in the day of judgment. And the next verse reminds us that we need have no fear of our standing before God, because we are born of God. The kind of fear in verse 18 is referring to the trembling, sorrowful, despairing kind described, for example, in James, who tells us that the demons believe that there is one God and shudder in fear. The second type of fear we find in the Bible is what has been mentioned here largely this morning, that reverential awe type of fear. It's meant to be the controlling force of what we do in our lives. And this is the type of fear that we saw in the earlier account of the midwives. When the phrase, the fear of the Lord, was being translated in the New International Version, they decided to put the word reverence, which speaks, I think, clearer to this generation than fear of the Lord used to in earlier generations and earlier translations. So I think that word perhaps helps us understand more the meaning of this phrase, fear of the Lord. Living in reverence and awe of the Lord is not only a command, however, for us as individuals. In the final address that Moses gave to the people of Israel before they crossed to the promised land, this is what he said. Now, Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. As a community, the Israelites settled into the promised land, and their attitudes, their ways of living, were to be shaped by the Lord's commands. Those commands were to make Israel a different people to the surrounding pagan nations. God wanted their lives to be a beacon of hope to the surrounding tribes and nations, and to draw those nations from their idols, from their pagan gods, to the living God. In the 4th century AD, in the seaside town of Caesarea, and I had the privilege of going to Caesarea last year with these two people.
When
and
we went to Israel.
When we, well, Holy Land. I spent 2 weeks in a bus with these people, so. What happens on a bus stays on the bus, yeah? Okay. So, in Caesarea, in the 4th century, there was a plague. People fled the town because of the plague, which caused the death of many. There was a historian living at the time, Eusebius, and he wrote this about the young Christian community in the town at this time. This is what he wrote. All day long, some of them, and he's referring to the Christians, tended to the dying and to their burial. Countless numbers with no one to care for them. Others gathered together from all parts of the city, a multitude of those who were withered from famine, and distributed bread to them all. This is a community living in reverence of the living God, written by an historian for us to read and be encouraged by, maybe rebuked. A few years later, not long after this plague in Caesarea, the pagan Roman Emperor Julian wrote to his priests, the pagan priests, about the actions of the Christian community during a time of famine and plague. This is in another part. Emperor Julian wanted his pagan priests to imitate the actions of the Galileans, the Christians, rather than fleeing and seeking to save their own lives. And this is what was written by him. So this is what he wrote to his pagan priests. When it came about that the poor were neglected and overlooked by the priests, then I think the impious Galileans, the Christians, observed this fact and devoted themselves to philanthropy. They support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us. The actions and the lives of these 4th century followers of Jesus flowed out of their reverence for their living God. It's important for us to grab hold that our reverence for God is an attitude of the heart. The actions that might flow from revering our living Creator God will be diverse, depending on our age, the time that we are living in, where we are living, what our talents are, and so on. Our actions, our words, our attitudes flow out from our daily remembering and experiencing that we are the undeserving receivers of the grace and mercy of our holy God. We are not doing or saying something to prove our worth before God. How we live, how we play, how we worship, how we do community reflects our experience and understanding of the deep, undeserved grace and mercy God has showered on us. The way we live our lives here as a faith community in Christie's Beach and as individuals, wherever you work, study, play, recreate, read, flows from our heartfelt thanks to the grace of our awesome and holy God. As Baptists, that's what you are if you're sitting here, as Baptists, our origins of the Baptists are traced to a group of Christian people living in England in the early 1600s. And you've got some English people here who are pastors. I mean, not from the 1600s. Okay. They might want to know. This small group of believers in the early 1600s feared the Lord. They held the Lord in great reverence and awe. And when they were studying the scriptures, they became convicted that the state church, which at that time was the Church of England, was teaching some things that were contrary to the laws of God. This group, Baptists, did not withdraw from the world or from society, as some Christian groups do, but rather they intentionally wanted to live within their society in a way that reflected the teachings of God. This group, by outsiders, were called nonconformists or dissenters. They didn't call themselves that, but that's what they became known as. Because as God-fearing people, they were making choices that at that time were quite contrary to some of the laws and customs of where they were living. And like the midwives, they chose to live lives in a way that flowed from their experience of God's grace, but which at times resulted in conflict with laws of the land, and for some time in prison, and loss of everything they owned. So what does it mean for us as individuals and as faith communities to be God-fearing, God-revering? Well, it can mean that our individual relationship with God could take us into unexpected places. The midwives, when they woke up that morning, didn't know they were going to be called into the presence of Pharaoh and given a command. They just woke up, being midwives. The young Christian church in Caesarea didn't plan to come to the attention of the Roman emperor. As a God-revering community, they simply served and worshipped God in the place and in the circumstances in which they were living. We live in a time similar to the time of Pharaoh in the Exodus account. This is a time when people, just like Pharaoh, have forgotten the gracious actions of God in the shaping of our society, our laws. As individuals and as a community of people who love the Lord and revere him, I think we can be both challenged and encouraged. As a God-revering people, we know that God gives all we need for the time and the place where he has put us. C.S. Lewis wrote in his Narnia story, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that our God is not safe. He cannot be tamed. But he is good. So as we revere God and we remember his actions in our lives, both as individuals and as a community, we grow in godly wisdom. We don't know where he's going to lead us, what the paths ahead are for us, both as individuals and as a community. But our God is good. He blesses his people. So let us leave here this morning, not as a people of fear, not as a people of fear, but a God-fearing, a God-revering people of a holy, loving God. Amen.